Tom Oxley is building what he calls a natural highway into the brain that lets people use their minds to control their phones and their computers. The device, called the Stentrode, could improve the lives of hundreds of thousands of people living with spinal cord paralysis, ALS, and other neurodegenerative diseases. Leaps.org talked with Dr. Oxley for today's podcast. A fascinating thing about the Stentrode is that it works very differently from other brain-computer interfaces you may be familiar with, like Elon Musk's Neuralink. Surgeons implant some BCIs directly into a person's brain, but the Stentrode is much less invasive. Dr. Oxley's company, Synchron, opts for an ingenious natural approach, using stents in blood vessels to access the brain, which offers some major advantages to a handful of people who've already started using the Stentrode. In our conversation, Dr. Oxley talks about what it means to have a Bluetooth brain, the critical role played by AI in the present and future of BCIs, how BCIs compare to voice command technology, regulatory frameworks for revolutionary technologies, specific people with paralysis who've been able to regain some of their independence thanks to the Stentrode, what it means to be a neurointerventionist, how to scale BCIs so that more people can use them, the risks of BCIs malfunctioning, organic implants, and how BCIs help us understand the brain, among other topics. Dr. Oxley received his PhD in neuroengineering from the University of Melbourne in Australia. In addition to being the founding CEO of Synchron, based in New York, he's an associate professor and laboratory head of the Vascular Bionics Laboratory at the University of Melbourne. He's also a clinical instructor at the Department of Neurosurgery at Mount Sinai Hospital. He's completed more than 1,600 endovascular neurosurgical procedures on patients, including those with aneurysms and strokes. And he's the author of over 100 peer-reviewed articles. One thing to note is that the audio gets better about 10 minutes in. Everything before that is audible, but we did have a headset issue early on. Personally, I was hanging on every word throughout. Dr. Oxley's work opens up game-changing opportunities for many patients, and his views on the present and future of BCIs are must-listening for anyone who cares about the future of health and technology. I'm Matt Fuchs, and this is Making Sense of Science by Leaps.org. Welcome, Tom Oxley, to the Leaps.org podcast. We are really excited to have you on the show and looking forward to talking with you about Synchron and the work you're doing with BCIs and specifically Stentrode.
Thank you, Matt. Happy to be here.
Just for our audience who might not be super familiar with the term BCI, brain-computer interface, could you give a sort of a high-level description of what a BCI is?
Sure. So a BCI, well, I guess I think about BCI as an implantable brain computer interface. So that means it's a medical device. It goes into the brain, and there's a couple of different ways that different groups are building implantable brain computer interfaces to get into the brain. So open brain surgery or minimally invasive brain surgery. For us, we do endovascular procedure, which is like in a cath lab where we use the blood vessels to get into the brain, and then we deposit electrodes onto the brain surface. And think of the electrode like a microphone, so it listens to local brain activity. And depending on what part of the brain that you're in, if you can hear the local brain activity, you can make predictions on what the brain is trying to do. So if you're over, say, the motor cortex, which is a part of the brain that controls your body's ability to move, or the control of the ability to move, you can then make predictions about when the user is trying to move something. And if you can predict when the brain is trying to move something, you can take that information, digitize it, bring it out of the brain, and then turn it into a control signal, which can control devices. So basically, this is a medical device for people who are not able to use their hands, but whose brains still work, and we can use their brain signals to control a laptop or a computer without having to have any hand.
So what group or population are you most interested in reaching with this technology?
So brain-computer interface is a broad term. The first generation of, well, actually the first brain-computer interface was really the cochlear device that restores hearing for people who have loss of hearing. So that's an implant that goes into the brain and sends information into your brain to restore hearing. So that was really the first brain-computer interface. The next wave is going to be motor control. So it goes into the part of the brain that controls movement. So yeah, that's what the companies that are in the getting the attention around BCI right now are focusing on as their first application. So who are the types of people who have had injuries that stop their ability to move? It's patients that have had stroke, spinal cord injury, ALS, which is a type of motor neuron disease, things like multiple sclerosis, nerve injury, even severe arthropathies that stop your joints working. And think of anything that would stop your ability to use your hand to control your iPhone touching, you know, the screen.
This technology, compared to other types of BCI, what are the advantages of Synchron's approach over maybe more invasive forms of BCI? And one point of comparison would be the probes that require open brain surgery to install, where a surgeon's cutting through the skull with a saw. I imagine your approach mitigates some of the risks of such surgery, like infection, hemorrhage, complications from anesthesia.
Yeah, so there's the safety profile. We have decades of knowledge of the safety of leaving devices like stents inside blood vessels in the body, including the heart and the brain. So there's a knowledge around the fact that a device can stay inside a blood vessel wall for a lifetime and not degrade. There have been some questions over the long-term viability of products that sit within the brain, the way that the brain reacts to those products. That's one part of it. I think the bigger part of it is the ability of a large number of people to access the procedure. And so for procedures that require open brain surgery, you have to be at a quite a high level hospital that has open brain surgery expertise. For the type of technology we're building, you only have to go to a cath lab. And because stents and pacemakers have been around for decades, there are cath labs available in a very large number of hospitals, and that infrastructure already exists. So I think we believe that the solution of using the blood vessels means that the technology is going to be available to a very large number of people very quickly.
And when we're thinking about who is going to use this particular technology, is it mostly focused on people who have spinal cord paralysis? Or I know there's over 30,000 Americans who have ALS, different mobility issues, and I think 300,000 people I read have paralysis. Is that kind of the main population of patients that you're hoping to reach through the Stentrode?
Yeah, the patients that we have implanted so far in our clinical trials include ALS and stroke. Mm-hmm. We've had approval to do other conditions like spinal cord injury and MS. So those conditions will also be there, but I think ALS and spinal cord injury and stroke will be the three primary conditions that are focused on initially.
I want to also ask, are there signal advantages for the Stentrode over brain implants, where the implant is actually inserted into the brain? My understanding is that with the penetrative electrodes in the brain, you can have these fibrous brain cells forming around the electrodes that impede the signal quality. Is that an issue that your technology maybe helps to solve?
So there's a downside and an upside to the way that you put probes in. So yes, you're right. One of the downsides to putting probes directly into the brain is that there is an inflammatory reaction over time that pushes the probe away from the brain cells that are firing. The upside, however, is that you can get information down to a very low number of neurons, which means you can train those neurons to do great things. So I think what we'll see is that the probes that go into the brain that can deliver lots of information out of the brain could function at a very high level, but there's a question over the stability of that functioning over time. So to counter stability, if you give up the number of neurons that you're firing from. You record from a population of neurons from a bigger electrode. So we do that by not penetrating into the brain, but sitting on the surface of the brain. And that's called, rather than penetrating, it's called surface electrocorticography, or ECOG. And by recording from a population of, say, rather than a handful of neurons to more like hundreds or even thousands or tens of thousands of neurons, you're recording from a population of neurons. And that tends to be a different type of signal called an LFP, local field potential. LFPs are known to be more stable over time. And if you think about it, and so you don't really have the fibrous issue because you haven't put the electrodes down into the brain to cause that reaction of sitting on the surface of the brain. But the fact that you're recording from a large population of neurons means that there is a greater stability over time. But you can't train those neurons to do as much as what you could if you're down at a single neuron level. So I think it's going to be interesting. There's going to be different types of approaches, different technologies that come out that achieve different levels of control that we're going to see do different things for patients. It's going to be a very interesting next 10 years to see what the impact is of these different types of electrodes in the brains.
And where does voice command fit into that picture? Because I think some of the people that we're helping, they're still able to talk, right? So what are your advantages of your BCI over voice command, where people could, you know, tell the computer or their phone to do certain things?
So voice command has a technology that's improved hugely over the last decade and continues to be super useful, but it does have limitations. The voice command is best when you're trying to do large amounts of text or speaking. Like, say I don't know if you ever use it, but I tend to use it when I'm writing out like a long essay or a long note. But if you're trying to do multimodal control of different systems, voice command doesn't tend to be that useful. So even for people who have preserved voice but who can't click on anything, it's very hard to tell a computer where to click and how to switch between programs and how to jump between different applications. So I think voice will continue to be improving, but at a fundamental level, you still need a way to be able to input key presses into systems. And so that's actually the basis of our system. We've boiled it down to try and keep a really simple, basic, fundamental key press process. So we're calling our system the Synchron Switch, and it allows basic key presses, which you can assign to do simple things. But if you think about the low number of buttons that you need to use on your iPhone now, relative to where technology was 10 years ago, our patients are able to generate key presses in multimodal functionalities. And some of our patients have preserved speech and some do not. And so often the combination of some preserved speech and then other things like eye tracking plus our key presses all provide a very important mechanism to control systems. But if you're able to take away your finger and try and control your system without using your fingers at all, you quickly realize how important it is to tap on things.
So when people are using the Stentrode and they say are interfacing with a computer that they want to control through their BCI, are they sending a message through the BCI? Say if they want to move a cursor up, they think cursor up and then it recognizes that brain signal and moves up. And then when they want to select, they think something along the lines of select. Does it work like that, or am I mischaracterizing?
Yes, that's right. We have the patients think about certain tasks that are motor origin, like moving their foot or moving their hand or moving their elbow or moving their or leaning, and we can configure certain key presses to do certain things. So things like moving up or down, left, right click, zoom functions, and then we have radial dial functions, like think of like an iPod, which, you know, allow the users to navigate different ways around the computer. It's certainly not as fast as us using our 10 fingers, but it's a starting point for the technology that provides utility. And so maybe that's the other thing to point out is we are focused on trying to solve the needs of patients with severe paralysis. And so this is not a technology to, you know, listen to Spotify or to watch YouTube. We're very focused on trying to help the patients do things like the things that we take for granted that we use our smartphones for that make us independent, like basic levels of communication, calling out for help, text messaging, doing banking, doing shopping, controlling the environment with, you know, lights or climate control. They're the things that make us independent.
So how much is this replicating what, you know, you and I can do with our computer or iPhone or other devices? Has the technology progressed such that it is sort of simulating what a person could do with their fingers? Or is it like, I would imagine it might be a little bit slower or more cumbersome?
Yeah, no, it's definitely slower than what you or I are doing with our fingers. Actually, Apple has been building really beautiful accessibility technology. So we've been we're actually focusing a lot on iOS control, so iPad control. And if you look into the Apple system, the accessibility features provide mechanisms of sending key presses that provide mechanisms of control through the computer. Like an example would be with a low number of switches, if you hit control tab, you can navigate your way around the screen by selecting certain things on the screen and then selecting items you might want to do. So with a low number of key presses, plus, you know, integrations like large language models, you can begin to make predictions for the users to make selections on screens that might, you know what you want to do, and it takes you there, and then you can achieve things. So we're certainly not building this, you know, in isolation. We're focusing on systems like iOS that are widely accessible to a large number of people and leveraging the great work that's been done by Apple.
Yeah, and I do want to ask a little bit about LLMs in the context of your technology, the large language models. But I also want to back up a little bit and talk about you a bit. I've seen you described as a neurointerventionist, and I believe you've performed 1,600 or so endovascular neurosurgeries. I think at the top you mentioned that you have that background in neurosurgery, in which the surgeon is using medical imaging to guide catheters into the neck or head. How did you get involved, and what inspired you to focus specifically in this very important work on BCIs?
So neurointervention is a field that is quite new in medicine. Neurointervention. So intervention in medicine typically means going inside the blood vessels. And so that started in the peripheral leg and the heart. And then we had stents that replaced, you know, open bypass graft surgery. And now there's structural disease treatments for valve problems in the heart. And then over the last 15 years, it's made its way into the brain. And so the treatment of ruptured aneurysms, the pulling out of blood clots that cause strokes, the injecting of glue into arteriovenous malformations. It's become a really exciting and fast-moving field within medicine. I always had a love for how the brain worked from an electrical point of view. How the brain generated consciousness was always something fascinating to me. But I was watching what was happening in the cardiac space and realizing that this trend in medicine towards minimally invasive therapies, and in particular using the blood vessels, was taking off in neuro, and I thought that's really cool. And so I started to develop an interest in that space before it was getting too big. And then I saw brain-computer interfaces emerging around as I was doing my internal medicine residency. Before I started neurology, I started reading about brain-computer interfaces. And brain-computer interfaces have been, you know, there have been academic reports of implanted BCIs for motor control going back to 2006. In fact, back to 1999 by Ian Kennedy. There's actually a Netflix documentary about him called Father of the Cyborg. Dr. Kennedy was the first person to do a human brain-computer interface implant, 1999. It's now 2023, and we're still reading about incredible academic pursuits of BCI, but they're all in academic settings. And so I think I took a pragmatic view early that the blood vessels could be an avenue by which you could deliver electronics into the brain and not have all the other issues that come with open brain surgery and what you talked about earlier, the scarring. Now, you definitely don't have as much information coming out of the brain, but you have enough to drive systems. And once you start to solve the problem of delivering electronics into the blood vessels, if you can miniaturize that, you can get to more and more regions of the brain because the blood vessels go everywhere. So for me, it just seemed obvious or inevitable that the endovascular solution was going to be the ultimate solution that solves this problem within BCI. But as things have gone on, it's become obvious that there's more there than just BCI for blood vessels into the brain. I mean, other things that require open brain surgery, like deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease and epilepsy, brain monitoring for people that are having seizures, and then mapping of the brain, which is something that's done in cardiac a lot. None of these things exist within the brain just yet because they all typically require open brain surgery. So just feels like there's this huge horizon of opportunity to help people with a range of conditions if we can solve the technical challenges that come with delivering electronics into the blood vessels. But what's awesome about it is that it's kind of like the skin, like the way that the blood vessels regenerate themselves and the way that they scar. It's like a tattoo. If you put a tattoo at the base level of your skin, it just stays there and doesn't get rejected. That's what we know about putting stents inside blood vessels. You can put a metal, you put an object on the base layer of the endothelium, which is the inner wall of the blood vessel. Cells will grow over it and then they'll stop and it won't continue to inflame or scar. It can just sit there for a lifetime. So it's a real opportunity to use that as a mechanism to put electronics all the way throughout the brain. It feels like it's the beginning of a very long journey that hopefully we're just starting.
And if there's no scarring, then the cells don't interfere with the signal. Is that right? Because I think I've seen it described that when there is scarring or other issues related to the trauma, if you will, of having an implant inserted into your brain, that can interfere with the signal.
Right. That's true. But I guess it's one of stability because so what happens in the blood vessels is that you put the metal on the wall, cells grow over it to about 300 microns thick, and then they stop. It's just like a little scar forms and then it stops. Inside, you've probably heard of the blood-brain barrier. So if you cross that blood-brain barrier, you go into the brain, the way that the scarring happens is different. And it's like if a foreign body is in the brain, it continues to get rejected and continues to have this inflammatory reaction. So if you stay just on the outside of the brain tissue, but the blood vessels run along the inside of the brain, you can still get to a lot of regions inside the brain, but avoid that type of reaction because you just sit in this safe layer of the blood vessels.
You mentioned that a lot of this work has been done in the academic setting, but you are doing research on people who have ALS and I believe other issues with cognition. And I've seen the Stentrode described as a brain Bluetooth, which sounds really cool. It'd be great if you could help put a face on this. Can you tell me about some of the people with paralysis that you've helped to regain the ability to text, email, shop, online bank?
Yeah. So our first implant was a gentleman in Australia, and his name was Graham Felstead. And he suffered from ALS, and he had gotten to the point where he couldn't really speak and he couldn't really move his hands anymore. And his wife, Nancy, was doing everything for him. And when we first got it working, he wrote out his first sentence on the system, and we brought his wife into the room and showed her. And it took a while to get that first sentence out, but she hadn't quite appreciated what it meant. And so the thing that immediately changed their life was that we set him up with WhatsApp because he was no longer able to do any text messaging. And it was a bit clunky, but he was able to get out sentences on WhatsApp. And then Nancy, therefore, was able to get a communication from him without having to go into the room, stand right next to him and try to interpret what he wanted or what he needed at the time. So once he could do that, she was actually able to leave the house and go and do other things. And so he could then communicate with her whenever he needed to. So it's kind of like if you have these medical conditions that take away your ability to live with autonomy and agency in the world, you then become very dependent on people around you. And that has a rippling effect. And then if you give them back digital means of interaction, of communication, of control, then the world opens back up a little bit. And I think that's the power of this technology. It brings you back your autonomy. But And just another point to something that we're starting to realize now is, if you set a goal of making these systems perform at a really high level, that's great. But actually, what patients want more is something that's always working all the time and with little effort. So we're realizing now that simplicity in design actually is much more important than approaching a really high performance rate that comes with instability and training and effort for something that's simpler and easier to use with low training. So that's been an interesting part of this journey, and that also tends to come with stability as well. So I think that'll be the starting point from a design perspective that we'll build upon.
Yeah, that sounds like a great lesson learned for a lot of different types of technologies. I think that there's some other companies that could take a lesson from what you're doing there with that goal of simplicity and reliability, rather than trying to, you know, shoot for the moon sort of, and not try to offer these things that are a little outside the comfort zone of the technology. Are there any advantages or any use cases to the more invasive form of BCI? Just wonder about speech or like operating a wheelchair, perhaps, that will the Stentrode be used for some of these other use cases?
Yeah, I think we've got a vision for different types of physical control in the world. We chose not to start there because it comes with another layer of safety that you can imagine if there's a difference between moving a cursor around a screen to moving a wheelchair around a street. And so we wanted to start out with a level of confined safety. But the concept is that we're building out a digital control language. So it does have the potential to turn into an API where there's a range of secondary use cases. And yes, we do believe that we can move into two-dimensional, three-dimensional trajectory control that can deliver those types of outputs. We haven't shown that yet, but we see a trajectory to being on that pathway.
Are you finding that any of the other BCIs that do involve more invasive implantation are making progress in interesting ways? I'm curious, just because it's sort of newsworthy still, that Neuralink got the FDA approval for the in-human clinical study. How did you receive that news? Does that sort of seem like progress in the field, or do you think that these implantable BCIs are sort of not the right direction necessarily compared to the Stentrode?
The Neuralink announcement was a great step forward for the field, and I look forward to seeing what they're producing. But probably the biggest recent, the top of the game recent paper that comes to mind is from both Eddie Chang's lab in UCSF, as well as Jamie Henderson and Lee Hochberg's lab, and Krishna Shenoy's was there as well from Stanford. And they are showing with quite large numbers of channels going into the brain with open brain surgery that they're achieving very significant high speed rates of speech generation.
Like 80 words a minute?
It's even faster than that, actually. And it's pretty incredible stuff to see. And it shows the potential of where the system can go. Turning that into a fully implanted system with a power source that can be held internally, and using that level of data processing is going to be a real challenge to turn it into a commercial system. But it just goes to show that if we can deliver electronics into the brain in a scalable way, then this technology, it's hard to see the ceiling of where this technology can go. And it kind of speaks to the power of the brain. You know, you've got 80 billion neurons in there doing incredible things. And in a sense, we're kind of limited because the only way that we can provide the output of all that computational power in our brain is through the motor system, through the muscles of our fingers and the muscles of our mouth to talk. But once that information gets digitized, our ability to interact with technology is going to be far superior from a digitized point of view than the method we do it through our human body. So it's very exciting. It's we're seeing the start of a very new technology that has the potential to solve a lot of ailments and eventually take us to a level of functioning that is superior to what our human bodies can do. But I think that point is still a long, long way away.
That is intriguing. And what is the role of AI in that digitization in terms of recognizing unique brain signals for speech and training people and training the AI, I suppose, to recognize their signals? I imagine the AI is playing a very important role.
It's playing a huge role. So I guess there's the AI which does the prediction and the training of the neurons themselves. And then there's the AI that sits on the other end that uses those predictions and amplifies the potential outcomes. So I'm thinking of the large language models that drive GPT as a mechanism of predicting what those neurons wanted to do. So you've basically got, you've got the brain, you've got the AI predicting what the brain's doing, and then you've got the AI predicting what the output needs to be. So there's these three layers of intelligence, two of them artificial, one of them non-artificial, combining in a way that is logarithmic in each domain. So it's pretty awesome. I think for our use case with our first output, first generation system, with the key press system that we're sending out of the brain, the sort of lower number of key presses that are stable and more simple, the interaction with that against a large language model means that we can have ChatGPT type systems that are contextually dependent, that know what the patient wants at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning or Friday evening, and then offer solution to the patient, which can be selected. And Eddie Chang's work recently published at a UCSF did this as well. They created a digital avatar of the user and then use the brain signals to drive the performance of that avatar. And I think that's the way this goes in general, is that the AI, the predictive models, don't just predict the neuronal cells, but they predict the behavior and contextualize behavior of the users, and then, you know, create digital avatars of what that patient is trying to do.
You sort of hinted or alluded to the broader applicability of this to, you know, maybe people who are not suffering from a cognition issue, although that is clearly in the future for now, sort of a sci-fi idea many, many decades in the future. And I think that I've heard you say that what's really important right now is having a strict regulatory framework for keeping BCIs to the patients who really need them. But, you know, this is a small population of people, relatively speaking. So with this framework, does it interfere potentially with the scalability that we're going to want in the future to, once it does become more broadly applicable, to reduce costs, given that, you know, we want this to be accessible, right? So that it won't sort of result in this dystopia where there's certain people who are able to access it and have these powers, and then other people who can't access it.
I think, you know, as you go through an FDA process to get a medical device cleared, you have to be really clear with what the use case is. And, you know, this is a brain implant. It comes with risks, and you have to weigh up the risk-benefit ratio. And so I think the concept of the BCI eventually leading to these consumer humans wanting implants to make themselves live at a higher productivity rate, I can see that the trajectory gets there one day, but The reality is the technology is right now being built for people with severe injury and disease. And so we don't go to the FDA saying, you know, I want to build a scalable BCI because I, you know, I'm looking towards consumer applications. You say we're building this BCI to solve this particular problem, and that's what we're going to get approval for. So how that unfolds over a period of time remains to be seen. But it really does matter that the initial use cases are going to be built for spec to solve particular problems for patients. And I think what happens after that, I mean, I don't know, there are examples, I guess, in medicine where early technology starts out with a particular use case. I mean, one that springs to mind is LASIK, where, you know, LASIK was initially for severe, although LASIK's having, I think, some issues now with safety concerns that are coming out later on, but LASIK became a medical procedure which you could pay for if you wanted yourself, where you didn't really need it, but you didn't want to wear glasses, and it became a medical procedure. And so, and then, you know, if you look at the cochlear device for hearing, that started out with very severe hearing, and then it became moderate hearing, and then it went to children. Actually, I think it might have started in children, but now they're selling cochlears for moderate hearing loss. And, you know, if you look at the direction cochlear is going, you can now get a cochlear device implanted and connect it directly to your iPhone, but people are not doing that at a consumer level yet. So you know, I think before we get to consumer stage, it's going to be, can you or can you not control technology in a way that's satisfactory to you? And that point is shifting, right? Because right now, if you lose control of your iPhone, you want it back, and you want it back quickly. And, you know, I don't know what we're going to be controlling in 10 or 15 or 20 years, but as technology continues to improve, human capability improves, but we're still very dependent on our human bodies to be able to control that technology. So I think step one for BCI is severe motor impairment, but then probably what's after that is mild or moderate impairment while there's this shifting rapid progression with technology use that we want to keep up with because we've become dependent on it to engage in the world. So I think that's the way it will go well before there's, you know, augmentative type approaches.
So we had a piece on leaps.org last year on Argus 2, and this was a retinal implant that gave some degree of vision to people with macular degeneration. But the company Second Sight went out of business, and it left people who had the implants in a bad place where there's no one to help them maintain or replace their implant if that's needed. As with any technology, BCIs can become outdated as newer, more advanced models are developed. Is this a concern for Synchron, and how are you addressing it?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is that once the system is up and running, it's kind of, you know, like a mouse. It will just work, and you're not going to keep needing upgrades to make it keep working. So if we were to stop building upgrades, then at least they'll have the system that's working to keep going with. But probably the more important thing to say is that, you know, we are hoping to demonstrate the long-term safety of this system, even if it's removed. So if you remove the portion out of the chest, you can leave the portion inside the blood vessel, and that remains inside just like a stent. And we know that the long-term safety of stents is like, and it's got a very good profile, and we hope to demonstrate that same profile. So, you know, this is not a situation where we've left a big hole in the skull and we, you know, and it's, you know, causes an ongoing infection risk. So I think there's a difference. And I'm not sure exactly what was left with the visual prosthesis, what was left behind, if there was something coming out of the eye. So I don't, you know, it's a bit of a different situation, but it is a challenge. And I can't deny the fact that as with any medical implant, there is the possibility that that happens. And so we have to do as much as we can to provide a system that works for patients immediately and that it'll keep working. And, you know, but that's part of the risk, I think, that the patients take on when they go for the procedure.
Quick follow-up, organic materials? I know the Stentrode is made of biologically inert material that'll eventually be reabsorbed into the body. That's certainly reassuring in its own right. I'm just curious, if you think the future Stentrode could be made from organic materials that would further reduce any risk of adverse neural response to foreign materials?
That's interesting. The problem with organic materials is that they would eventually disappear. So you'd need, if you're putting an electronic circuit in there, you want that circuit to remain, otherwise the system won't work anymore. But we do have some technology that has portions of the system dissolving and leaving. You want to leave as little behind as possible that lets the electronic circuit do its job. So there is the possibility of components of, you know, bioabsorbable parts of the system that can disappear over time.
Tom, sorry that we ran over a couple of minutes. Thanks so much for spending the time telling me about your important efforts with Synchron. Amazing to see the progress you're making. And the overall potential for the field of BCIs seems really fascinating and promising. Looking forward to continuing to follow and cover your work.
Thank you very much, Matt. I enjoyed the chat.
Thanks for checking out the Making Sense of Science podcast. If you like the show and you want to hear more from the best thinkers of our time to help make sense of the latest health innovations and their impacts, please hit the follow button. And in the meantime, visit our online magazine at leaps.org, where you can read in-depth articles that explore health breakthroughs through the lens of rational optimism. Thanks for reading, listening, and most importantly, thinking about what you find on leaps.org.